Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning into The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, July 1st. We learn more about the richest man in Japan. He is knee-deep in water wars on Maui. We hear from the National Park Service as it navigates through this next phase of what happens at Kalaupapa on Molokai. And in our Mono Minute, we highlight a finch from the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. And learning more about Hawaii's last queen, first through her diaries and now her letters, we get a snapshot in time. And come with us on a quilt along as we prepare to mark this nation's 250th birthday and stitch together America's story. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, we highlight a story about the richest man in Japan. It's the cover story of Hawaii Business Magazine this month. Editor Jennifer Ablon spoke with Tadashi and I to try and understand what makes the mogul tick. We spoke with Ablon earlier this morning.
It is an untold story about Tadashi and I, who is one of the wealthiest people on planet Earth. He's worth $65 billion. People know him as the founder of Uniqlo. I'm sure you know what Uniqlo is, Catherine.
Yes, do love that store, I have to say.
Right. But the one thing that people do not know about him is that he also runs a Hawaii company called TY Management. And TY Management has found itself and Tadashi and I at the center of one of Maui's most consequential debates over water, infrastructure, and community stewardship. You know, Yanai has proposed contributing tens of millions of dollars of his own personal money to help modernize West Maui's aging water infrastructure with the goal of transferring those improvements to public ownership.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's been lots of news, you know, about the state of water, the water wars, as many stories bill it, because it's very contentious.
Very contentious. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of ink dedicated to what's been happening on Maui. He owns golf courses. And of course, there's been a lot of talk about Maui Land and Pineapple and its lawsuit against Mr. Yanai and TY Management. But I think, not to relitigate the issue, the untold story is that Mr. Yanai, who is Japan's richest man, came to Maui for golf, and he fell in love with golf. And now he's in the middle of this water war with Maui Land and Pineapple, which is the modern heir to the plantation era. He has told Hawaii Business Magazine that I am one of the richest men on earth, but making money alone has no meaning for me. He has told me that the money should support society and community, and that's why he has proposed a $40 million contribution to the aging infrastructure of Maui. Now, $40 million is a lot of money, but this is something that he's committed to. And, you know, I've spoken to residents of Maui who, quite frankly, do not care about what billionaires are doing in Maui. Their concern is how to sustain future generations. And this is something that Lauren Palikiko, a Maui resident, has told me time and again.
I know we were hearing that his mother was very frugal, and he cares very deeply about, you know, natural resources. And that is what is driving some of his efforts.
Right. I mean, Mr. Yanai, again, has floated contributing somewhere between $30 million and $40 million toward repairs and upgrades to West Maui's water system, though those figures are rough estimates. So they're not hard caps. And among the proposals under discussion is repairing aging reservoirs, fixing sections of the Hono Kohau ditch system and building transmission lines capable of delivering recycled wastewater to Kapalua, his golf courses, you know, reducing dependence on stream diversions during droughts. So that is where a lot of this stems from, Catherine. As you noted, he has a personal connection to water. But again, he has said that making money alone has no meaning for him. It's really giving back to the community. And I asked him what he thought about the PGA Century Tournament being canceled for a second consecutive year. And as you know, that generates roughly $50 million annually for the island's economy. He told me that he's very sad and disappointed, but he's determined to bring it back to Maui. It also is in connection to the Sony Open, which also has been canceled.
Right. And we did see him step up and donate lots of money to the charities that normally would benefit from these golf courses, you know, early on.
Right. I don't have the hard figures in front of me, but he is a very huge donor of Maui. And that's because he would like to live in Maui one day permanently. And I asked him, why? Is it just for the golf? And he said, well, it's actually, Maui has been good for his health. So he not only has a connection to water, but as we know, Maui is one of the most peaceful, most beautiful places on earth. And he said, he disclosed that he feels very peaceful and calm in Maui.
Yeah, well, it's just so interesting, you know, because you do provide a different glimpse into the water wars and I guess his motivation, maybe. We'll let the lawsuits play out in the courts. But you see this story just as indicative of what the public-private partnerships that could be developed here across the state?
Exactly. So Hawaii Business Magazine just launched their very first P3 summit, Public-Private Partnership Summit. And governments provide oversight and accountability, but private organizations contribute capital, millions of dollars, innovation, and expertise. So the most successful partnerships recognize the value of both, right? A win-win for all parties. And one of the best examples that, or one of the most visible examples of redevelopment is the Aloha Stadium through the new Aloha Stadium Entertainment District project. Hawaii Business reported in March that the state is partnering with Aloha Halawa District Partners. And you can see that this successful partnership is playing out. The project will replace the shuttered Aloha Stadium with a new 31,000-seat multi-purpose venue. And they're transforming the 98-acre site into a mixed-use district that includes housing, hotels, retail, entertainment, office space, and community amenities. The P3 summit that we held in May discussed aging infrastructure, housing shortages, rising costs and growing demands on public resources. And if we don't get the private sector and public sectors together, I think it's very difficult to really have these Aloha stadiums to speak in the near future.
You know what, you folks have been tackling a lot of these, you know, really important issues to our economy. I believe in this month's edition, you also, you know, touch on the ConCon. Last month, you talked about the trend with Pokemon coming back with a vengeance.
I love that story. Pokemon is celebrating its 30th anniversary. For every story that we have at Hawaii Business, there's a business angle. The reason we wrote about Pokemon is that it's become a lucrative endeavor, as you know, Catherine.
Yes. I have spent lots of money. I think it used to be the Toys and Joy store in my neighborhood because my kids were so into Pokemon. And my son the other day, who is, you know, in his 30s, had said, Mom, you still have my cards? And so
yeah.
I just had to chuckle because, yeah, the Pokemon craze has come back with a vengeance.
The Pokemon craze is huge in Hawaii, but what I love about this Pokemon story is, you know, we talked about how people are making money out of this, but the card collectors have found community in it. So you'll see a lot of pop-up card shows, and they've become social networks now. And people have become close friends and neighbors because of the Pokemon craze.
That's just a wild, really wild. But my the reason why I was bringing this up is, you know, because you folks have just won another award.
We did. And this is an award that's near and dear to my heart because we've been recently recognized on the national stage for the fifth time in 9 years. Hawaii Business Magazine has been named the nation's best regional business magazine by the Alliance of Area Business Publishers. And we've beat out larger markets, including the Twin Cities and Texas, along with Florida. So I'm very proud of our team. Our team includes editors, writers, photographers, designers, digital storytellers. And I also, in a previous column, mentioned you and our friends at Hawaii News Now. So thank you for helping us elevate our storytelling.
Well, you know, congratulations and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Hawaii Business Magazine editor Jennifer Avlon. The July edition is out now. It is also the first of the month, so we'll be back after our monthly test of the emergency alert system. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from Ho'olanapua, working to prevent child trafficking through public education about buyer demand and the community's role in reducing exploitation. Resources at ho'olanapua.org.
Aloha, this is Derek Malama. Please join me for the first episode of Kanikapila Vintage, the new podcast from HPR featuring classic interviews from Kanikapila Sunday. We're kicking off the series with the Brothers Casimero at the legendary Mountain Apple Studios from 2004. It's available this Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Sponsored by Manu Healii.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The Kalaupapa Saints Tour, owned by patient Mele Watanuki, closed abruptly after her death last month. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel tells us that now the National Park Service is offering its own tour. It's the only way to visit the former Hansen's disease settlement. She spoke with the park superintendent, Nancy Holman.
One of the, you know, big pieces for a park like Kalaupapa is recognizing its significance to Molokai and the people of Molokai. And in my mind, Molokai and Kalaupapa, like, it should feel like a community park to Molokai. Like, this should be a place where residents of Molokai have access, right? Like, we can't necessarily discriminate for that access as a national park, but there should be ways in which this community has, you know, at some level easier access, although access to Kalaupapa is never easy. But I do think that is really important. Certainly with this tour, we were trying to resolve a couple things. One is not everybody can afford to fly. The flight logistics are difficult. So giving people another access point to the park was really important for us in our planning. We've been working on this for a couple years. We've been sitting with this release date for several months. And the idea would be that this would be in addition to that commercial tour. So you'd have a flight-based, you know, vehicle-based tour, and you would also have a hiking-based tour, like a walking tour, so that there would be multiple ways to access and experience the park and the story. You know, unfortunately, with the passing of Auntie, it didn't work out that way. And, you know, we'll continue to work on strategies to have other access points.
Just the timing of it, and that was one of my initial questions when I heard about this, was just, you know, it seemed really soon after, you know, Auntie Millie's passing and the tour's situation. And I think it gives a lot of context to understand that this was planned before that.
Yeah. I've been working on this for at least 2 years, and, you know, the government rarely moves quickly, and we do that for a reason, right? We are publicly accountable for what we do, and we serve such a large audience, and we needed to make sure whatever we were going to do made sense. And part of that was, again, like, this is the first time the National Park Service is operating a tour at Kalaupapa. You know, everything prior to this was not done by us. Some of it was approved by us as we came in 1980, but, you know, tours have been happening down there since the 50s.
You talked about this being sort of geared perhaps more toward Molokai residents or wanting to increase access for the Molokai community specifically. And I just wondered if you can talk a little bit about the tour experience itself.
Travel to Molokai is still difficult. Like, there is still only one servicing airline. This walking tour, we heavily recommend that people are on the island the night before for this tour, because we do start at the trailhead at 7:30 in the morning. So it's pretty risky to fly in that morning to Molokai, get a rental car, and make it to the trailhead in time. And we have a pretty hard start time for this tour. So, like, there's a pretty good probability you'll miss your tour if you were to try to fly in that morning. You know, and also Molokai as a whole, there's not a lot of accommodations over here and so forth. So our release is also small as an experiment to build up towards these larger goals in the future. We're capping at 10. So it'll be 10 participants and 2 staff members. And part of that is to allow, we hope people will make good decisions. Like, we've done a lot of work to figure out how to describe the experience so people don't bite off more than they can chew. It's a big, physically demanding day. You need to be very comfortable walking 8 miles and 8 difficult miles. There is not an option for flying out. You need to be able to hike yourself back out at the end of the day with us. But having a second staff person and having a small group also allows us to be flexible to that group and adapt to that group. And if we need to turn people around in that first mile and send them out with one of our staff people, we'll do that. I guess I would recommend to people, if you don't think you can walk 8 miles comfortably now, like, kind of give yourself some physical training and, you know, get a reservation for a later time frame. We're only opening reservations 30 days in advance. So there's time. It's not like all the tickets have sold out between now and infinity. There will be time in order to get a reservation at a later date if you don't feel like you're physically capable now, but you think you can work up to that. The tour experience itself is really an interpretive tour. It's an educational experience. It's not fast. You know, we really want people to experience this place in a way that helps them understand the patient experience with the place. So it's really about the story of the people who were isolated and then later chose to continue to live there after the law was repealed in 1969. So it's a look at the history of the place. It's a long story. It's a big story. You know, there were 8,000 people interned there. So, you know, every one of those individuals is an individual with a different story. So we're really trying to help people leave this experience with a sense for the complexity of this place and a greater understanding of these individuals that lived there.
You talked about the planning that went into this and the thought process. Was there a community consultation process? Was the community involved in input at all on this? Or what was that process like?
So I'm working off the general management plan, which was signed in summer of 2021. And that really sets out that vision for future visitor services. I do listen. I mean, I attend community meetings both as, like, someone who's, you know, facilitating that meeting, but also just as a participant, and really listen to what people are saying, what they're concerned about. I spent a lot of time talking within the Kalaupapa community, especially with the patients on this tour. But we didn't come out and say like, hey, we're going to do this walking tour, because again, this is like one experiment towards this longer goal. And like one of the things we're really looking at is A, access point. There are only two to the park, right? Like flying in or hiking in. Is this a viable mechanism for people to access the park via the trail? You know, because most people came in either via plane or mules in the past. So like without that mule operator, like how viable is it to use the trail? What does it look like to get that? Like, for instance, like, are we going to see a lot of medical emergencies on the trail that we need to account for, right, as we go forward? Some of this is just sort of like build up and experiment all towards that goal of the general management plan speaks of a couple of things. One is it talks a lot about carrying capacity. Like this is a really important and significant site. It's a cemetery, it's a living community, and it's a national park. It's our enabling legislation when we were created as a national park. It's very specific about being a place of education and inspiration and research. So this is really like a place where you bring reverence to the experience when you visit here. So in many ways, these are opportunities to continue the conversation with the public on the way towards having those much bigger, richer public conversations where we're making big decisions.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I really appreciate you taking the time to go through all of that with me.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel and Superintendent of Kalapapa National Historic Park, Nancy Holman. That tour they were talking about will cost $20. It can be booked up to 30 days in advance, beginning on July 9th. And you can find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org, later today. On today's Manu Minute, we have the song of the Nihoa finch, which are endemic to Nihoa Island in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands and found nowhere else in the world. These recordings are courtesy of Zeno Canto. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The Nihoa finch is a ground-nesting Hawaiian honeycreeper that's found only on tiny Nihoa Island in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands and nowhere else in the world. They're a bit smaller than their close relatives, the Laysan finch, but otherwise look similar, with the males mostly bright yellow and the females duller, with dark brown streaks on their head, breast, and back. Both sexes have big, sturdy seed-eater bills that they use to eat a huge variety of foods, including fruits, seeds, leaves, flowers, insects, and even bird eggs and carrion. If you're lucky enough to ever visit Nihoa Island, you can't miss their lively, canary-like song. Nihoa finch were recently given the Hawaiian name Palihoa, as their original name seems to have been lost. While their population seems relatively stable at about 3,000 birds, they're listed as an endangered species because they're vulnerable to catastrophic events, such as hurricanes. To lower the risk of losing them this way, they were introduced decades ago to Tern Island, further to the northwest, but that population went extinct by the early 1980s. Fossil evidence shows they were once also found on other Hawaiian islands, including Molokai and Maui, but tiny Nihoa is the only place they've managed to hang on, likely due to the lack of predators and mosquito-borne disease. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, exploring Hawaii Island with kama'aina and visitors, offering volcano adventures, waterfall experiences, and more at hawaii-forest.com.
Today we bring you news of a book that aims to provide a glimpse of the lives of the monarchy and Hawaii's last queen, Queen Liliʻuokalani. We were fortunate to have board members of a group called Hui Hanai in the studio yesterday, which included Ahari Spore, Hamnani Apoliona, and its chair, Diane Peters Nguyen, starts us off.
Hui Hanai, I can't speak to exactly how the organization got the name, but it is interesting. Hanai, meaning to adopt, Hamnani is the Hawaiian language expert here, but that the queen herself was Hanai'd, and it serves, the organization serves to perpetuate the legacy of the queen, and also in its earlier years, really was a support organization for Queen Liliʻuokalani Children's Center, which of course comes under the Queen Liliʻuokalani Trust today, as it's known, taking care of children who are orphaned and destitute, and, you know, that is defined if they have one parent or less.
Well, you know, talk about this project that you folks are undertaking.
Well, this is our third project with David Forbes, the most recent one being the Diaries of Queen Liliʻuokalani. The one before that was he did the preface for Hawaii's Story by Hawaii's Queen. And so, as you know, he passed recently, and we are so thrilled that this project is actually going to be coming to fruition. So it was part of our work in perpetuating the Queen's legacy by publishing things such as this book. We've also done a film with Edgy Lee in 2018 on stories about the Queen that have been shared throughout generations. We also have another line of publications. We did the Nanai Kikumu series and the Queen's Songbook.
Hardy, talk about why this project is so important.
You know, it's critically important. We've been at the forefront, thanks to David, with the diary of the Queen, and that's a remarkable publication in and of itself. But the Queen herself had six siblings. All of them were Hanai, which is interesting historically. The interesting thing about the letters is that the letters that David has selected move from a time when she was just a young girl, a lady, but young, in her teens, to a time when she got married, of course, to John Dominus, all the way through to the very sad ending of Princess Kaʻiulani, who passes in 1899. During that period of time, you actually see the maturity of the queen and just how brilliant she was. Despite personal sadnesses, there were, as I say, seven in the family. Three had passed away before her brother Kalakaua had become king. So we call them Nalani Eha, the four of them, who were actually the survivors of the children. But as you read the letters, you see how she transitions and matures to a truly ruling monarch. You know, she writes a letter, her niece, Princess Kaʻiulani, who's in London going to school, writes a letter back when she has just become queen, just before 1892. And she asks her auntie, the queen, if she will appoint her father, Archibald Cleghorn, to a position in the government, governor of Oahu. And the queen satisfies her niece that indeed she will. And then there's a interesting paragraph there about Kaʻiulani's two cousins, Kuhio and David. And she says, they need to grow up.
They're the surfers, right?
Prince Cupid, they're the surfers. And that's a real interesting story because they introduced surfing, along with their other brother, Edwin Kaliʻahunui, to California.
Yes.
But they never really take it the next step. Edward passes away, leaving the two, David and Kuhio. When they finish their studies in California, where do they go? They go to London to see their cousin.
Yes, and I think there's a museum there that tells that story.
That's right.
So it's just terrific that
they go down the street where Kaʻiulani is going to school, and they obtained three wooden ironing boards. And those are the ironing boards they take to Brackenham Beach
and surf.
And to the amazement of all these English people who don't have a clue about what's surfing tells.
Love that story. And so, Hamnani, talk about what you're struck by with these letters and the kind of the slice of life that it presents.
Well, you know, in terms of what the Ohana was doing and the queen was expecting to be done, and You know, it comes across to me that Liliuokalani was one serious person, and it's amazing that this one woman, having gone through these different iterations of her lifetime, and then ending up in her effort to continue to secure her kingdom, it's really amazing. And what strikes me for just talking about David Forbes in the context of his work, I was just sharing with Hardy that because of, you know, he's getting into his research and just being dogged about it, we hear stories about people who had working relationships with him, Barbara Pope, but even someone as young as Puake Onokomaier had knew of him,
yes,
and worked with him. And then someone as young as Jason Achiu and Susan Shaner having that relationship and capacity. And everybody that spoke of him, what I could gather from reading, they attributed he was dogged and focused. Mm-hmm. So it's a very amazing thing that this man devoted his whole life to the purpose of uncovering information. And fortunately enough, he did focus in on the Ali'i, our Ali'i Nui, our constitutional Ali'i, et cetera. And so I think it's a great thing that we through the Hui Hanai effort, collective effort, now have an opportunity to strengthen what he would have certainly wanted to help move forward, because it's going to benefit all of us, Hawaii'i, Makahonu'i, all around the world.
You absolutely know,
because the Queen was international. And it's about time that people understand the Oivi, the Pauai people, but in the kingdom, it was everybody, so it's not exclusive. But it's important that we don't forget, because we had a government and we had a kingdom and we were able to function and be productive. And so I think to be able to, one, be sure that the verification of what is being said is accurate and it's not just somebody making up stuff.
Right, or just getting it wrong.
Yeah, the credibility of it all. I think that's key. And so going back just to Mr. Forbes and, you know, his efforts, I can just kind of envision him in the stacks, just covered over. But it takes that kind of focus, commitment, and judgment, I think. And so I think that, you know, now we have a chance to help share and spread that information and with good credibility. And so that's for Hui Hanai to be able to do this, and it's along with special support and interaction, collaboration with others is the key. Yeah. And that's it, collaboration.
Well, Diane, I think we just owe the world to David Forbes. I know he just was a fixture down there at the State Archives.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
He loved pouring through those boxes, through all those papers.
He did. He certainly did. And we also owe, you know, a great debt to our funders, because I just would mention that the Hawaiian Native Corporation very recently gave us a very generous grant, as well as funding from the Liliuokalani Trust and the Christina Hassel and Waters Martin Family Foundation. So this is the work that Hui Hanai does. We have no paid staff. We cannot do this. And, you know, so we have titles through the UH Press that go out of print. We have to reprint them. All of these things cost money. So we're very grateful to our funders.
Yes, and the fact that they are standing up and saying, well, we think this is important. Something's of value.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anything else you want to add, Hardy?
I think it's important to realize that the Queen is really at the crossroads of Hawaiian history. You walk into the palace, and in the grand hall, looking down upon you are all the Kamehamehas. And many times I've been asked, how come we're in David Kalakaua's palace, and all the Kamehamehas are up there on the walls looking down at us? Well, you have to realize that she was at a time when there was transitions from the Kamehameha family, Ohana, to the Kalakaua family. But they were really very close, because the birth parents of the Queen were actually descendants of two of the four royal consulars of Kamehameha. Two, of course, are those two twins that we see on the coat of arms. And when you look at, I mentioned that all the children of Kapa'akea and Kaloli were Hanai'd. They were all Hanai to members of the Kamehameha family, mm-hmm. Princess Ruth to Kamehameha III. So that relationship was so close And if you look at some of the king's correspondence, he will always say how much he was indebted to the work that the Kamehameha family, particularly Kamehameha I, did in creating the kingdom of Hawaii. So the queen is at the justification of moving from Kamehameha to Kalakaua. And of course, Lili'u Kalani, I should say.
It was interesting to me. I think the most charming part of the letters that we read were just between Lili'u Kalani and Ka'iulani, who talks about her time studying in England. She's studying French and German, music and history. But to Hardy's point about the bloodlines, when the queen does ascend to the throne, they're already thinking about who her successor is.
Yes.
And I think Kalakaua had at some point made some sort of pre-arrangement with the Emperor of Japan, but she wasn't interested in that. Ka'iulani wrote a letter back to the queen saying, thanks, but no thanks. And then the queen had suggested either Prince Kuhio or David Kawananakoa, and Archie Cleghorn wrote letters and was very opposed to that. So, and of course, it all then unraveled before that succession could take place. But
And the story gets more interesting.
It does.
Yeah. I was fortunate to be in Brighton and see where she stayed, and she studied with the governess, Mrs. Rook. And so it was just wonderful history. You know, and to know there in London, they still talk about those stories, you know, when Hawaii's ali'i
princess
were there. Yeah, it's terrific. The princess and the princess.
And I think it does, you know, that you mentioned too, humanize the ali'i in a way. I mean, this the insight through the letters. They're people. And I just had to laugh. There was one letter, Miriam Likelike, to her husband saying, you don't love me. I don't know why I'm writing you because you don't love me. And he writes back, of course I do. I love you. But, you know, you really see
the humanity of it all. Humanity of it.
Yeah. Well, mahalo for sharing your manawa today.
Thank you for having us.
Mahalo, Catherine.
We've been hearing from board members of Hui Hanai, who are excited to announce they have received funding to work on publishing Queen Lili'u Okalani's letters. It was a project started by the late David Forbes, who also worked on the Queen's diaries and Hawaii story written by the Queen.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, focused on local innovation, decarbonization, and investing in renewable and locally sourced energy solutions. Learn more at hawaiigas.com.
Can science tell us anything about our spiritual lives? Psychologist Lisa Miller says the answer is yes.
Just as there are neural correlates for depression or anxiety, it turns out that there are neural correlates for spiritual awareness.
How spirituality changes our mental outlook, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Hawaiian quilting is front and center in a nationwide quilt-along to mark the 250th birthday of our nation. What's a quilt-along? Well, it's a free virtual event where quilters work off the same patterns and sew at their own pace. The Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian commissioned patterns by five indigenous quilt makers to mark eras in American history. Today marks the release of the second pattern. It's designed by Sissy Sarau, a fourth-generation Hawaiian quilter and teacher. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Sarau and Inger D. Montesinos of the Smithsonian. Sarau starts us off.
Actually, I was Inger, I'm not sure if you emailed or you called and gave the invite to be part of this quilt along. And I've never done a quilt along before, so I was very happy to join this group of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians, because in our tradition of Hawaiian quilts, it's all about the story. We always go back to what the quilt means and what it meant for the quilter and who's receiving it and why we do it. And so for that tradition to be passed on a quilt along with a huge audience is something very dear to me, because Hawaiian quilting is such a small niche that anytime we can share what we do to everyone else is we're very proud of, that we are able to do that. So I have to thank Inger to give us this platform in order to share Hawaiian quilting with the rest of the world.
And it was so interesting to learn about you and your own background and the fact that you are a fourth generation quilter, and just the power that comes with being from such a long line of people practicing the craft.
Well, I was raised in quilting. My great-grandmother on my mom's side was a quilter, and my grandmother on my dad's side was a quilter, besides her relatives also. So anytime you went to either home, either grandma's house, they were always quilting. There was a quilting horse in the living room. And so that tradition was just passed on. And it's something that's very dear to us because of this tradition of it being passed on and now into the fourth generation. And quilting is not just about the legacy of passing on the style or the how you do it. It's the tradition and the culture that comes with it, the do's, the do nots with Hawaiian quilting. So being raised in it, being part of it, it's just something you picked up and you learned along the way also. And my parents were wonderful. My mom was, she only had one hand, and she was an amazing quilter. And my dad was the amazing designer, and his designs are basically renowned right now. And people still like to pick up his designs because of their meaning behind it. And I have to say thank you to my parents for passing on the tradition and even picking up the tradition, even as difficult as it was for my mom, she still did it.
Inger, give us a little bit more context about how this quilt along actually works. And you separated each block out into different eras of American and Native American history. So talk a bit about how you delineated and what these patterns will represent.
Yeah, it made sense since we were talking about America's 250th to think about a timeline. And so I broke it out into four different eras of U.S. history. So we have pre-contact up until the American Revolution, post-American Revolution, so the first 125 years, and then 20th century to the present, so the second 125 years. And then we have our shared future. And then we have a border theme, which we'll be releasing, which if you think about, the quilt will be a wall hanging and it'll be, you know, a chronological timeline from oldest at the top to the newest time period at the bottom, surrounded by a border theme with always becoming, talking about how we will, as a country, always evolve and always grow and always change. So, you know, we have that reflecting our four periods of U.S. history. But, you know, just like in Hawaii, it was, you know, missionaries who taught quilting, and the art form just, you know, each tribe, you know, made it their own art form. And one of the reasons why when I was searching for artists, for Native quilt artists and designers, I really wanted to make sure I captured the broad geographic diversity that we have in the Native communities in the United States. And for me, the very first one that I thought of was, I need a Hawaiian quilter. It's such a beautiful quilt style. And it's, you know, for someone who's never done it before, it's a little bit intimidating. And I'm so glad that, you know, we found Sissy, because I've never done a Hawaiian quilting before. And Sissy's instructions was wonderful. Her block is so great. It's such a great block for beginners. And so I was really excited to try it and do my first Hawaiian quilt.
I mean, that sets you up perfectly, Sissy, to talk about this block pattern. There's the pattern itself, but there's the story of the pattern, how you adapted it from one of your father's designs. And I mean, so much meaning there.
Yeah, the design itself was actually adapted from a vintage Hawaiian quilt that was in my great-grandmother's collection. So it goes way back.
Way back.
Because back in those days in the 1920s, even the 1880s, when the quilting just started, you made a big size quilt. You did a queen or you did a king. You did not do smaller quilts. Smaller quilts didn't come in until the late 1960s, early 1970s, when they adapted it down to smaller quilts. So my dad bringing it down to a cushion size kept the meaning of it. And so when I was asked by Inger to be part of this quilt along, I wanted to also adapt it to a smaller size, but keep that vintage tradition, that design, because it means so much from being passed on from generation to generation, even though it got smaller and smaller and smaller to the 10 by 10 that we're working on. But I love the design. I love the story behind it. And I think it's not just Hawaiian quilters or people in Hawaii that can relate to it. Everybody can relate to the story behind it.
The pattern is called Kanani Oka Home, and it tells the story of a daughter leaving in the diaspora.
Yes, it was a daughter leaving to move to the mainland, and the mom wanted to make a memory quilt that whenever she's homesick, open up the quilt and you'll be home again. So a lot of aspects in the larger quilt, the chicken in the yards, the fence, and it was such a wonderful meaning to even bring it down and even further down. And so I did ask a couple of mentors of mine that, you know, I said, this is what I'm doing because of this was so special. I wanted to make sure I got it right. And so usually it's called The Beauty of Home. And he's a kahu, which is he's a priest here, or I should say a minister, a Hawaiian minister here in Hawaii. And I asked him, I says, should I still keep the same name? And he kind of looked at me and he said, after I explained everything, and he said, oh, Sissy, he says, it's my beloved homeland.
That's wonderful. Sissy, you shared that you have taken up the mantle of teaching these weekly quilting classes in addition to, you said, twice a month on Thursdays on the other side of the island. But talk a little bit about the community that has formed and that you have really helped to nurture.
Yeah, it's interesting that quilting is just not about sewing. It's a community of friendship. There were many friendships that were formed within the class. There are quilters in my class that were taught by my mom, taught by my dad, taught by me, taught by my sister. And so this community is still going strong. It is my family, my quilting family. And we absolutely love and adore each other. And everyone is welcome into this community when they come to the classes. And I haven't met any quilter I disliked. They're all honest. And it's about the sharing. And it's not just sharing quilting. We're sharing each other's life with each other. And that's another main reason why I enjoy the quilting classes and will continue it.
And preserving an art form that has been so important in Hawaiian history and letting that live on.
Yes, it's amazing because these quilters, we just had a quilt show, invited to a quilt show last month, and they are so giving when I have to say, I need quilts. And they're like, which ones? Which ones do you want? Which ones do you want to hang up? And they're so giving in saying, we want to be part of it. And that's why we do it. We want to show people what we do, who we are, not just as a quilting group, but as a community, as a friendship. And we will continue that as long as we can.
What a beautiful way to reflect on what 250 years means. And it's a craft that I imagine as you're doing it, you have a lot of time to think as you're busy with your hands. So, Sissy, I'll give you the last word. Anything else you want to share?
I really want to thank Inger for giving me this opportunity in sharing Hawaiian quilting with a larger audience. Hawaiian quilting is such a small niche. And there are people out there that have never seen a Hawaiian quilt. They don't know about the traditional Hawaiian quilt. And having this platform able to do that is I'm just so happy that we could do that and share our culture, because our culture is part of this quilt. Our stories are in the quilt. Our traditions are in the quilt. And I hope one day they all can come to Hawaii. I hope they can do the quilt along. I think they'll enjoy it. But when they come to Hawaii and join our classes and see how special it is.
That was Sissy Sorrell and Inger DeMontesinos. They spoke with HPR's Maddie Bender, and we will have links where you can find out more about the virtual quilt along. Sorrell also leads quilting classes every Saturday at the Higashi Hongwanji Mission in Liliha. We are out of time, so we have to go. But up tomorrow, we plan to hear from the new head of the Public Utilities Commission, where some big battles over our energy future will be playing out. Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archived shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.